From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the terrorist threat is called severe, complex, and evolving. What can be done to help control violent extremism?
When grievances aren't resolved in a peaceful manner, well, then there lies the opportunity for other actors to insert themselves into those spaces and to foment discontent and potentially violence.
After the French attacks, a new novel feeds divisions, and China dispatches civilians to patrol the North Korean border area. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. British Prime Minister David Cameron says Britain faces a severe threat of terrorist attack, while a European law enforcement official describes the security environment as difficult. VOA's Victor Beatty reports a U.S. lawmaker also warns of a growing threat of homegrown violent extremism.
Appearing on the CBS program Face the Nation Sunday, British Prime Minister David Cameron says Britain faces a severe threat, saying an attack is highly likely.
This threat keeps morphing because it's the same fundamental problem, extremist Islamist terror. The threat has changed and altered, but it's still based on the fundamental problem of a poisonous death cult narrative, which is the perversion of one of the world's major religions.
Mr. Cameron says the struggle against these extremists will take a long time and require international cooperation.
If we take the issue of Islamist extremist terrorism coming out of Iraq and Syria, it is going to take a very long time to deal with this, where we'll have to show real perseverance. We cannot do this on our own as Western countries. We need functioning government in Iraq, functioning government in Syria, to be the legitimate authorities that, with us, help to stamp out this perversion of the Islamic religion.
The director of the European Union's law enforcement agency, Europol, Rob Wainwright, says a determined police response is underway in the wake of the January 7th and January 9th terrorist attacks in France that killed 17 people.
We've seen action now in Belgium, in Greece, in Berlin, and other locations as well. And it shows, I think, the nature of the threat that we're facing right now. It's spread across so many European countries, perpetrated by a community of possibly thousands of people who have been radicalized on the internet by their conflict experience in Syria and Iraq, and many of them have returned to European society, perhaps some of them with the intent and capability to carry out the attack.
In an appearance on the ABC program this week, Wainwright says it is not just the scale of the problem police are facing, but the nature of the threat has changed since the September 11th, 2001 attacks in the United States. He says there is no clear command and control structure. However, he says there is a concerted effort underway for greater cooperation among counterterrorism services, including the sharing of intelligence and the tracking of terrorist financing, illicit firearms, and the monitoring of terrorist activities online. Also appearing on Face the Nation, Senate Intelligence Committee member Marco Rubio says, along with the external threat, the United States faces the potential of attack from homegrown violent extremism.
And what's made it more interesting, of course, and more dangerous is that, in fact, some of these individuals that are plotting these attacks may not even have traveled to the Middle East. They've been radicalized in a local mosque or online, and they've received instructions and or inspiration about how to carry out these attacks in the West from online platforms. So I think that's a very real risk for Europe, which is closer to the Middle East and has large immigrant populations from that region. But it's a real risk here in the United States, a country where every single year millions of people visit, travel to, immigrate to.
In an appearance on the NBC program Meet the Press, Senator Lindsey Graham, a member of the Armed Services Committee, insists the Islamic State group and al-Nusra Front in Syria and Iraq remain the biggest threats to the United States. He says success against them would change the landscape of the security threat worldwide. Greg Barton, director of the Monash University Center of Islam in the Modern World, says a tipping point was reached when the IS group captured the Iraqi city Mosul and called on its allies to launch lone wolf attacks wherever they are.
Quite separate to that, we have ongoing concerns with Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the situation in Nigeria and surrounding Cameroon goes from bad to worse. That doesn't project beyond the region at this point, but it does remind us that together with the problems in Somalia and Kenya with al-Shabaab, that we're facing increasing challenges on all fronts. And at the very least, that calls on international resources and stretches those resources thin at a time when it's increasingly hard to know which turn developments will take.
Barton says al-Qaeda has been around for 30 years, and with newer groups on the scene, he agrees with Prime Minister Cameron that a solution to terrorism is decades away. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Violent extremism results in death, maiming, terror, chaos, destruction, and sometimes the displacement of hundreds of people. And extremists are emboldened and ruthless as at any time in recent memory, according to Michael Stanisic. He is head of International Relief and Development Stability and Governance Practice, which aims to counter extremism around the world. We asked what has contained extremism in the past to some degree.
I think that's a loaded question, actually, and one which really has we have to look back at the history of how we approached our foreign assistance. And primarily it was contained because borders were far easier to control and information wasn't as widespread or as accessible as it is now. And so the interconnected nature of our world has diminished borders, even in instances where leaders may not want to do so, which has caused more fluidity and the ability to cross borders around the world.
And this has all got to do with the rule of law, doesn't it?
To some degree, rule of law, but there are plenty of socioeconomic issues that could be present. It could be a rule of law, a breakdown of rules and norms in societies, a lack of enforcement efforts to enforce laws that are in place. But the key element here is that all of these things start at the very ground level of the places where we work, and so it's community by community, and it's really grievances-based types of issues. And so when communities don't have the ability to resolve their grievances or disputes in a manner which is accepted by the whole, then you have opportunities for other actors to interject themselves into the dialogue.
Is it also a matter of having an opportunity? Some of these extremists, they don't seem to be coming from places where they have opportunities for their future.
Yes, I think that's a large component of what we're dealing with and seeing globally. It's come to the fore more because we have access to this instantaneous information, and so with all this information at the fingertips of individuals and oftentimes without the resources to act internally to where their homes are and their home countries are, they look outside to either put the blame on individuals or groups or countries, and it serves as a recruitment tool to some sorts.
What kind of programs might help in controlling extremism or curtailing it?
It depends on where we're talking about. We can go back to the history of development, but I don't know that we need to devolve into that so much. But looking at how we're able to be proactive in our programming now with the understanding that in 10, 20, 30 years, it's going to reap the fruits of what we're doing. And so when you look at even the term countering violent extremism, it serves as an indicator that violent extremism exists. And so I would prefer that we start taking a more proactive approach to that and understanding the grievances at these local levels in advance of violent extremism fomenting.
Well, what is your organization doing to try to help curtail violent extremism?
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. We're focused significantly on community mobilization activities around the world, and so we engage with communities at the point of departure. And for example, in the Sahel, we're running a three-country program, which is looking at disaffected youth, women, and empowering them, giving them the tools and resources to potentially mitigate conflict. And this can take any number of shapes or forms. For example, there's a participatory theater mechanism which has been used not only by IRD but others, and it's a very effective way to reach out to communities in rural areas with high levels of literacy. And so these are communities which are really driven by the word of mouth. And so when you're able to engage in that platform, you're able to essentially counter narratives of those extreme elements that are working in those spaces as well.
And you're seeing results.
Yes, but this is not a quick fix. And though countering violent extremism is kind of the new term that's being thrown about, the problems remain constant and have been the same for eternity, essentially. When grievances aren't resolved in a peaceful manner, well, then there lies the opportunity for other actors to insert themselves into those spaces and to foment disconnect, discontent and potentially violence.
Michael Stanich, head of International Relief and Development Stability and Governance Practice. He's author of the report, Fragile States, Violent Extremism Pressures Rules-Based International System. Friday, we reported that recent opinion polls are showing a large percentage of Americans favor at least limited military operations against the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. This indicates a change of heart. Shelby Telhami, a scholar with Brookings Institution, spoke further about the subject with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi.
Following the recent massacre carried in Paris by Frenchmen who got trained in the Middle East, is the American public concerned about Americans joining ISIL to come back and carry attacks on the American soil?
When we did our poll, it was, of course, before the tragic attacks in Paris. But nonetheless, we did ask questions about how worried Americans are about other Americans joining ISIS and carrying attacks on American soil. And we find, actually, that almost half of the American public is at least somewhat worried about Americans joining ISIS and carrying out attack in the U.S. And although only about 12% are very worried. But still, it's clearly something that they're concerned about. And my suspicion is that the attacks in Paris probably raised that level of concern. But just to put it in some perspective in terms of comparison, we also ask, is your concern about Americans joining ISIS and carrying attacks in the U.S. greater or lesser than your fear for Americans joining al-Qaeda? And what we find is that slightly less than al-Qaeda. So while it is an expressed concern, it converges very close to the worry about al-Qaeda, but not identical.
Did your survey of American public attitudes toward ISIL detect any perception of a correlation between the escalation of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and the potential ability of ISIL to recruit fighters?
You know, one of the things that we tried to do is, particularly after Secretary of State Kerry in one statement with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, had said that something along the lines of violence on the Israel-Palestine issue could be used by ISIS to recruit or to enhance its power. And I know he got a lot of political criticism, so we decided to put a question on that in the survey, trying to see whether the American public believed that violence on the Israeli-Palestinian issue is likely to be used by ISIS to enhance its recruitment and focus more attention against the U.S. and Israel, or whether the two issues are totally independent, that ISIS will do what it will do regardless of the Israel-Palestine question. And the answers were interesting because we find that actually two-thirds of the American public thinks that there is linkage, that Israel-Palestine really fuels ISIS. And we also find, interestingly, that among Republicans, there's even more such belief, that over 70% of Republicans actually think that violence on the Israeli-Palestinian front would be used by ISIS to enhance its power and focus attention on the U.S. So clearly, I think the general attitude in the American public is that there is linkage for sure.
University of Maryland and Brookings Institution scholar Shelby Telhami. As France reeled from back-to-back terrorist attacks last week, a biting fictional novel about France under Sharia law went on sale in bookstores. The timing of Michael Holubek's book, called Submission in English, was coincidental. But as Lisa Bryant reports from Paris, it is now part of a swirling debate about the country's very identity.
The Giberjean bookstore in downtown Paris is almost empty on a recent evening. A few people wander through the literature section, but a pile of books with red and white covers is left untouched until Jacqueline Boedes makes a beeline for it.
Là, il parle de l'islam. Moi, je suis née en Algérie. C'était une colonie française.
Bouadis likes the author, Michel Houellebecq. He talks about Islam, a topic that resonates with her. She was born in Algeria to a Jewish mother. She likes his spirit. He likes to provoke, she says, and she, too, is a rebel. Houellebecq's latest novel, The Stack in the Bookstore, is called Soumission, or Submission in English. Even before its publication last week, it was generating publicity. It's set in France in 2022, when a fictional Islamist party wins the presidential elections. Houellebecq has sparked controversy before. He's been sued and acquitted on grounds of inciting racial violence. He once called Islam the stupidest faith, although he's recently softened his stance, saying the Quran isn't so bad after all. But Submission's publication was sidelined by a bigger event. It hit French bookstores on the very day that Islamist terrorists attacked the Paris offices of Charlie Hebdo magazine. Houellebecq, who was making the media rounds to promote his novel, briefly disappeared from view.
Qu'est-ce que c'est, Michel Houellebecq? C'est de la pure fiction? C'est votre vision de l'avenir?
C'est une possibilité, probablement pas aussi court terme que dans le livre. 2022, ça paraît très tôt.
But in an interview on French TV the night before the attacks, Houellebecq said the scenario of a moderate Islamist party taking power in France is a real possibility. In his book, France under Sharia law turns out to be not so bad.
Ce qui est bizarre, c'est que c'est la première partie du livre avant l'élection du président musulman qui...
Houellebecq says the first part of Submission can make people scared, but the Islamist who comes to power is first and foremost a politician. He's a very ambitious man and a talented one. With last week's terrorist attacks, the worst French fears of extremist Islam have become reality. But the attacks have also sparked an extraordinary show of solidarity. As a nation moves forward, Houellebecq's book is part of a central question. Will it respond to militant Islam with fear and xenophobia, or by embracing its multicultural and multi-faith identity? Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Media reports from China say authorities are creating civilian militias to guard villages and towns near the North Korean border. VOA's Brian Patton reports.
China is organizing civilian patrols near the North Korean border in the Yanbian region, where a North Korean soldier reportedly killed four people during a robbery attempt in December. Kang Dong-won, a professor of international relations at Dongguan University in Busan, South Korea, says China is growing increasingly concerned about the security situation at the North Korean border. The measure organizing civilian patrols, he says, indicates that crimes are being continuously committed by North Korean soldiers and North Koreans. Despite widespread poverty and malnutrition in North Korea, the number of defectors crossing into China in search of food or economic opportunity has actually dropped significantly in the last few years. The drop-off is partly attributed to Pyongyang increasing the number of border guards and instituting harsher punishments for Koreans attempting to illegally cross the border. At the same time, the Chinese media have reported a number of assaults and killings allegedly committed by North Korean assailants in the border region. Matthew Horsall with Doriana, a Christian missionary organization that helps defectors escape from North Korea, says these crimes are being committed mostly by North Korean soldiers and are feeding into already widely held fears among Chinese.
What's a massive problem is the Chinese public's perception of North Korean defectors. You know, and the fact is that the Chinese do just see North Korean defectors as, you know, economic migrants and have very low opinions of them.
The establishment of the new patrols, as well as the installation of new surveillance cameras and a telephone hotline to report illegal activity in Chinese border areas, are intended to address growing concerns about safety and security. It is unclear if the so-called civilian militias are armed. It is illegal in China for private citizens to own firearms, although there are some exceptions for those who hold hunting permits. China and North Korea are close allies and trading partners, although analysts say Beijing is worried about the potential for regional instability and Pyongyang's continued pursuit of nuclear weapons in defiance of UN resolutions. Professor Kang Dong-won says the increase in crime and security measures at the border do not indicate any change in the relationship between China and North Korea. He says the authorization of the militia is just a measure to protect Chinese citizens living in the region near the border between North Korea and China. Beijing also recently lodged a formal complaint with Pyongyang about the alleged robbery attempt and murders by the North Korean soldier in December. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 19, 1806, Britain occupied the Cape of Good Hope on the southern coast of Africa. The territory was eventually ceded to the British in the Anglo-Dutch Treaty of 1814. In 1807, Robert E. Lee was born. Lee commanded the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia during the American Civil War. In 1809, author Edgar Allan Poe was born in Boston. Poe's writings were noted for their eerie and macabre subject matter. In 1966, Indira Gandhi was elected by her party to be Prime Minister of India, the first female head of government in India. In 1983, Nazi war criminal Klaus Barbie was arrested in Bolivia. Barbie was known as the Butcher of Lyon for having personally tortured French prisoners during World War II. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third Monday of each January, Americans honor the memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King, a Baptist minister from the southern state of Alabama, was a leader in the U.S. civil rights movement, advocating social change through nonviolent means. On January 15th, he would have celebrated his 86th birthday. Believing that change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle, Dr. King organized and participated in mass action boycotts, sit-ins, peaceful marches, and other nonviolent acts of civil disobedience. Dr. King once stated that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. And so, activists sometimes deliberately, but peacefully and respectfully, broke laws aimed at segregating the white citizenry from the non-white, thus hoping to bring attention to the inherent unfairness of such legislation. Thus, when a black seamstress named Rosa Parks broke the law in Montgomery, Alabama, by refusing to give up her seat on a bus to a white passenger and subsequently was jailed for her transgression, her plight generated national attention and increasing sympathy for her cause across the country. Dr. King was 39 years old when he died by an assassin's bullet on April 4, 1968. But his legacy lives on. In the fullness of time, segregationist laws were repealed. Discrimination is a legally punishable and punished offense. And even as we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and enormous contribution to society, Barack Obama, the first ever African-American U.S. president, begins his seventh year in office. I never thought in my lifetime that I would see one of us aspiring to be the head of our nation, said Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest sister, Dr. Christine King Farris. Mr. Obama leading us toward the presidency is like the promised land for us. Dr. King's life is well summed up in his own words. The quality, not the longevity of one's life, is what is important.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.